Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I mean, obviously, the book is brilliant and covers, you know, so much ground. But to sort of encompass his Congolese adventures are impossible. But what can be said is that he was one of the world's first great humanitarian crusaders, and his accomplishments in the Congo, and his accomplishments in relation to drawing a halt to this horrific, horrific barbarity and butchery that was going on there was one of the epoch's great achievements.
Yes.
Considering where he came from. I mean, this guy went there as a clerk. Yeah.
And if he'd stopped there, he would still have deserved fame and biography. But of course, then he moved to infamy.
Well, yeah, and we will get on to that. Like, he also then went to South America, and
he did found worse atrocities there. And that was very much British.
This is when he starts separating from his British identity.
Yes. So he's furious with the Foreign Office because of what he saw as the delay in acting on his report. But then there's another crisis in the rubber industry, in that the then largest company on the London Stock Exchange, recently floated, called the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company, owned by two vicious and dodgy Peruvian brothers. And it also supplied over 90% of Britain's rubber at this time, when a lot of rubber was needed. And reports began to filter back of, if anything, worse things going on in the Putumayo region of the Amazon. So Casement was the obvious man to go and investigate that. But it was incredibly sensitive investigation, because this was a British company. If it was declared bankrupt, which the brothers were always threatening to do, it would have a terrible effect both on Britain's finances, on the stock exchange, and to do with the supply of rubber. So it was a very, very delicate operation, which Casement, perhaps somewhat surprisingly for a man who went all out for something, performed incredibly well. He went on another river trip up the Amazon refused all the help the company were trying to give him, chartered his own boat, which meant it went a lot slower.
While the rest of the commission were enjoying the hospitality.
Exactly, on the company steamer. And but he saw then, the detail of that he wrote about then is just excruciating, of babies being thrown into fires and people being put in the stocks under the blazing sun and then beaten between the legs, and really dreadful things. But once again, he prevailed. When he got back to England and delivered his report, he then went to board meetings of this company, and it floated, it carried on. The law was changed. It had direct impact on company law that still stands today about what directors can and can't know. They have to know everything. And for this, because it was such a delicate operation, he was again feted around the world, but he was also given every honour. He was knighted. He was welcomed in the highest places. But he'd had enough of England by then. He always felt looked down on by the British Foreign Office establishment, who were all sort of Oxbridge-educated people. And he'd left school at 15 and made his own way, as he used to say. And also he needed a cause. By this time he realised that he had to fill himself up with causes, with his romantic emotional side, and that is when he began turning to Irish nationalism.
But was there not a deeper thing that he was coming to the realisation? And this is something that's discussed a lot now. There's a lot of, authors interested in this now, about the real nature of empire. The idea, in the British Empire, obviously, they were the masters at this, of this horrific genocidal sort of cruelty and the absolute contempt for local populations, alongside a quite brilliant propaganda machine that presented this as, because really, one of the things I thought about when I was reading the book was that King Leopold was doing nothing more than what he'd learned from watching the greatest empire in the world. And was there not a feeling, a very strong feeling in the book that having started off really a very loyal servant of Britain, that having seen how it all actually worked, that he became sickened to the extent that he was going to make a different, in what he thought was going to be a very decisive contribution, and that was to free Ireland.
Absolutely right. Yes, he was absolutely sickened by the empire, by the people who ran the British Empire, i.e. the Foreign Office and others. He wanted the Irish people to be as free as it was the first British colony, it should be.
But it's extraordinary how again the story, and again I cannot recommend the book enough to our listeners, but how, just as in Congo and as in Peru, which we haven't had that much time to talk about because your ties are very valuable, he started small. I just love this detail. Like, he began by helping to organise the Fesh in the Glen, the festival of the glens at Cushendall on the Antrim coast, harking back to the 6th century gatherings of the chiefs of Ulster and Tara. He championed the 14 families of Rathlin Island, the Irish-speaking enclave in Ballycastle Harbour, visible from Maharan Temple. He chartered a tug to bring them to the Fesh and was delighted when his charges took first prize in the pipes and dancing competitions, began to learn Irish himself. And, this was his method to become part of, and then to use his, absolutely original personality and magnetism to then advance the biggest possible cause.
Yes. Yes, he started off absolutely right in the cultural area, and then and worked his way up. And what really got him going on the in the biggest possible way was Carson and others forming the Ulster Volunteers and trying to separate Ulster out from any notion of home rule. And at that point, he changed gear absolutely. He wrote the foundation document of the Irish Volunteers. He spoke at the big recruiting meeting in the Rotunda here in Dublin. And he became absolutely 100% committed to a free Ireland.
And that part of his personality then became the dominant one. You know, any tussle or tension between the two, it was gone. And like, there's a great, again, there's something, you know, I think Irish people would recognize this when there's a passage in the book when it said when Ernest Shackleton was acclaimed an English hero and knighted after his 1909 South Pole expedition, Casement railed that if he had cut a cow's tail off, of course he would have been an Irishman, yes, right enough. And Shackleton, of course, was an Irishman.
Of course. And of course, the irony there is that a year later, Casement was knighted.
I know. Well, yeah,
but absolutely, he did. And he displayed a side to him that we hadn't seen before. I mean, he came up with the gun-running expedition.
Maybe you could just sort of... Because this part of it, I think, is worth dwelling. Maybe you could just explain that, the inception of, you know, his serious commitment to armed revolution, you know, to Irish freedom. Maybe you could just talk a bit about that and how that developed.
So during what became known as the Ulster Crisis, or known in England as the Ulster Crisis, when Carson and other unionist, conservative unionist MPs, I mean, these are people who held office in the British government. Carson went on to become Attorney General before he became Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. But these people were, and it's astonishing to me to think that members of the British Parliament were organising arms to come in to cut one part of the island of Ireland off from another. But Casement...
That being the Ulster Volunteers.
Yes, the Ulster Volunteers. Carson, et cetera, absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. And Casement saw, when this was happening, that the only answer was to form the Irish Volunteers and similarly bring in arms. And there's a scene where he's in Alice Stopford Green, who was the great sponsor of a lot of this, in her house in London. And Daryl Figgis describes Casement's sort of melancholy as he came up with the suggestion that Ireland had to bring in its own weaponry from Europe, the melancholy he felt, and that, to my mind, is the final sundering of him from England.
Yeah. I mean, that's that idea of, you know, he ends up on the scaffold. And Edward Carson becomes a hero,
yes,
and becomes the Attorney General. Yes. And in a way, it echoed down through the ages to the present time, really, where if you look during the Troubles, for example, the Loyalist paramilitaries were largely armed and funded through the security services. Internment, one of the first really, you know, dramatic, sort of inhumane, one of the big things that really started to turn everything, that internment of 2,000 people, I think 96% of them were Catholics, mm-hmm, you know, and how that really didn't change until, the last few weeks. Yeah. You know, but that sort of contemptuous attitude of successive British governments towards my community, you know, exemplified by people like Kemi Badenoch now and that sort of thing, and Boris, you know, which was like, Absolutely. You know, that we're sort of, you know.
Yeah. But there is a line in the book about how, you know, English conservative politicians have exploited Ireland. And again,
yes,
it's a very modern line,
it's
too.
It's a very, yeah, absolutely right. And in case, I mean, F.E. Smith, who was known as the Galloper because he did everything Carson told him to do. I mean, and 2 years later, he was then Attorney General and prosecuting Casement in court. I mean, it's extraordinary. Mm. But you're right. It is part of the modernity of Casement, the echoes of Casement, maybe, that carry on reverberating.
And how important was his profile in America then, when he turned to Ireland and became committed to it? Because he had got this great profile because of the work he'd done in the Congo and in South America.
He did indeed. And the Irish Republican Brotherhood wanted him to come to America, which he did in the summer of 1914, before the arms arrived, in fact, to raise funds and use his profile.
He was sort of doing that quite openly, though, wasn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, when he went to Germany, like, one of the most extraordinary things about it was when he went to Germany to start working on the gun shipments, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very openly there.
It
was causing a lot of disquiet at home, where people say, why is this guy in Germany?
But it's one of the things that struck me about the book. I mean, Erskine Childers, for example, who actually sailed the arms into Howth in July 1914, he was taken back into the Foreign Office, where he served throughout the war. I mean, did a bit of time in fighting in the war. But, you know, it seemed like once the war started, so all bets were off and everyone was back in.
Nobody was that sure what, I mean, I suppose in the English establishment then, nobody was that sure what to be doing.
No.
Because on the one hand, the plan was home rule.
Yeah.
You know, and then on the other hand, they had to deal with this burgeoning problem coming from Ulster and Edward Carson, etc.
Absolutely.
Ulster will fight and Ulster will be right.
And if Casement, he went to America to do fundraising. But as the war started, the funds started dry up, and he came up with this scheme with the Germans in the German embassy in America of raising men from the Irish prisoners of war to invade Ireland. So Casement, because Home Rule had been suspended for the duration of the war, and Casement's great fear was that if he admired the Germans a lot, and way back when he was in the Congo, he's writing favourable things about the Germans, the German Empire anyway, which was not a good empire either.
As it turned out.
Jesus. Yes. He,
not great, you know. You know. Yeah.
He was so... Partly he was panicked that if the Germans won the war, Ireland would never get home rule, because they would see Great Britain and Ireland as one country. So he was determined to free Ireland during the war with German help. So he came up with this plan that now looks, and at the time looked, extraordinary, to raise a brigade of troops. Germans would arm and give officers to invade Ireland during wartime.
But that plan, you know, how the fact that he was in America when World War I started, do you think it cut him off? Or maybe it didn't matter because of the way he was and how romantic he was. But the idea, like, he sort of was unaware of the feeling in Britain about what was happening once the war started.
No, I think he was well aware. I mean, the feeling had been bound up, and he'd written a lot of pieces about the German. They were back to sort of 1911. There were people warning against, including Conan Doyle, warning against the German shipbuilding. Erskine Childers, of course, had written his novel, warning of the German naval increase. He was well aware that the German threat was there, and that was part of why he turned to it. But I believe if he'd come back from America and lived an orderly life, there would have been no trouble at all.
But he also felt that Germany, like he felt that the rising or anything that would happen in Ireland was doomed without German support.
Absolutely, it was because Ireland was a colony of Great Britain, so it had no way of arming itself.
Unlike most of the armchair generals, of course, his real downfall was shown in the fact that he insisted on gloriously travelling with the weapons shipment to Ireland.
I think we'll come on to that. In fact, he was trying to stop the rising at that point. But I think the other critical thing in this period was he started this infatuation and affair with Adler Christensen, this 24-year-old Norwegian who was in fact married and had a child in Philadelphia, though I don't think Casement ever knew that. Who he met on Broadway in New York and who travelled with him to Europe. They were travelling under an assumed name. There's an elaborate man getting on and off the ship with the real name. And on Casement's first day in Europe, in Norway, Adler Christensen's home country, Casement writes in his diary that he starts his diary on that day, restarts his diary, saying that he sent Adler out to do some shopping, but Adler came back in a great state, saying he'd been accosted by a man in the hotel lobby who'd taken him off to a big building, which they looked in the telephone directory and realised was the British legation, and started quizzing him about travelling with Casement. Now, of course, since the papers were released in the 1990s into the National Archives in Britain, you can correlate that with the telegrams being sent from the legation in Norway, which make it quite plain that Christensen turned up himself of his own free will, told them he was travelling with Casement, and the clerk sending the telegram has written, "I suspect them of having unnatural relations," and then crossed it out.
But so why would Chris? Was Christensen an agent? Or
no, Christensen wasn't an agent.
Why did he present himself to the British?
He was after money, I think.
And he knew something.
And he got promised a huge amount of money. At the end, he was
promised £5,000, which is about £600,000 today, and. The man who promised it to him, the ambassador in Norway, was torn off so many strips by the Foreign Office for saying, you know, we shouldn't have promised him money. He's not working for us. And I think it was Christensen. I think it was devilment. He was a devil, and he never.
It was a bad article, as you said.
Once he was embedded, then that was Casement's doom then.
Well, it was, and what it did was destroyed Casement's mental health, in that when his recruitment program wasn't going well at all, and we can talk about that, he thought to sort of boost his operation, he got the German Admiralty, for example, to draw up a picture of minefields around Ireland, and he said, sent Christensen back to Oslo, take these to the British. And the British didn't swallow this for a moment.
They were good at blood, mate.
And Christensen then came back and said, they're sending half the Royal Navy to protect Ireland, and that's great for the war. And what's more, they want me to lure you into the North Sea and knock you on the head, which was these were the people Casement had worked for, and he felt totally betrayed. His recruitment wasn't going well because, perhaps not surprisingly, the Irish prisoners of war couldn't understand why they were being asked to, you know, their pay was going back to their families in Ireland. They signed up. They weren't conscripted. Their best friends had been killed next to them fighting the Germans. And they couldn't understand what was going on. This tall knight spoke with an English accent, lecturing them about the kings of Ulster. And they, none of them were signing up.
But so. this is the Irish Brigade that they were going to recruit from prisoners of war.
Yes.
And one of the other problems, as you said, was that the Germans kept presenting Englishmen as part of the brigade because they couldn't tell the difference between Irish people, Irishmen and Englishmen.
Yes.
So there were, and there was English people who saw it as an opportunity to get out of.
Completely.
Were saying we're, you know, doing a good kind of Irish accent.
Yes, and they saw it as a ticket home.
Yeah.
So this was going disastrously. And I think at the time that Christensen came back with the saying they want me to knock you on the head, I think he had sort of possibly 25 possible recruits.
So the fateful last voyage.
So he spent his second Christmas in, and then when Christensen left, Casement was distraught and he wrote him these sort of love letters saying life will never be the same without you. And he had a total collapse. He spent his second Christmas in Germany, Christmas 1915, in a sanatorium. He realised the Irish Brigade wasn't going to happen. The Germans were not that in, I mean, they had plenty of else to do than arm the Irish volunteers. So they eventually agreed only to send 20,000 very rusty Russian rifles back with the, and they wanted the brigade to go. Casement insisted on, by this time he realised that without German help, he believed the Easter Rising would fail. And so he insisted on going back alone, in fact, with two other people, on a U-boat. And his aim was to prevent the Easter Rising.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And he arrived on Banner Strand and before dawn on Good Friday, 1916. He was incredibly ill. He had been seasick all the way over. He was anyway ill because of his time in the Congo, had frequent malaria and so on. And so this wreck of a man staggered up.
And the ship that was meant to meet, they didn't show up.
Yes, the ship had been so heavily disguised as a Norwegian trawler that they had no radio, so they hadn't been told that the Rising had been put off. And so they were lingering on the wrong day and were intercepted by a British ship and were being driven into harbour when the captain scuttled his ship.
Yeah. Mm. And then they landed on Banner Strand.
Yeah.
And it is extraordinary.
What did Case would say when somebody said he was out walking his dog?
He said, what did he say when he was found?
Did he say something like
when
that?
So they landed on Banner Strand. There's no one to meet them because the local volunteers in Tralee didn't know that they were coming.
And they'd all been told to do nothing. Everyone had been told to do nothing until Easter Monday.
Exactly.
The rising had been postponed.
So there was nobody to meet them. Casement was exhausted and ill, and they were spotted by a couple of farm workers out early and a maidservant. And so the man who was with Monteith said, I'll walk into Tralee and get help. And they put him in this sort of ring fort called McKenna's Fort, just by Banner Beach, where he was sort of hidden by the hedges. And I think the third man of this party, who was called Bailey, gave the game away to the police, who turned up at the fort. They were searching the area. They'd found revolvers on the beach, badly buried on the beach, that they brought with them. And they turned up and said, they could see the back of him. They said, what are you doing here? And he said, my name, and he gave a fictitious name, in fact, of his best friend in England. And I'm here researching a life of St. Brendan. Yeah.
But I find it kind of extraordinary that the police, that he was, the people in Tralee who went to the police, because Tralee and Kerry would have been a very sympathetic place.
Yes, and they didn't know. Yes, and the other two with him were immediately looked after.
Yeah. And you described Austin Stack. I was shocked to find, described him as notoriously inefficient. Austin Stack, of course, my father played for Austin Stack's GA club in Tralee. They won't take kindly.
Fifty-two honor and medals or something like that.
But he wasn't much help, Austin Stack, it turned out.
Well, no, but possibly because this third man, Bailey, was misdirecting them. But the point is they never got a car to him.
Yeah.
And saved him. So he was taken away.
And that was it. That was the only night he spent in Ireland again.
Yes, and he spent it in prison. Yeah.
And then he was taken
on
the boat.
And then he was taken to England on the mail boat.
And and then I think we won't spoil all of this because the research that has gone into the description of the trial, the chapter's called The Forfeit. I mean, the research that has gone into that and how you've woven that together is masterly. Now that the moment was upon him and events were beyond his control, he was serene. Mm. He had his last platform, and that's how it's introduced. Yeah. And the description of the trial, the various advocates, I mean, I love the idea. I love the idea that the lead defence advocate collapsed.
Yes. Halfway through.
Collapsed.
I regret, my lord, to say that I've completely broken down.
Yes.
You're on trial for your life. Yeah. You don't want to hear that.
Absolutely. But what's also shocking is that no British lawyer would act for him. I mean, which is against all the codes of practice. So they brought over a sergeant from Ireland. And his other lawyer was an American who wasn't allowed to speak in a British court.
His only tactic was to attempt to quash the indictment altogether on the basis of punctuation. Which I love as you did. He said, God save, this is what Casement said afterwards, God save me from such antiquaries as these to hang a man's life upon a comma and throttle him with a semicolon.
Because this was the 14th century law which he'd been charged with.
It was a 14th century law, and the comma made the difference as to whether adhering to the king's enemies outside the realm, which is what Casement had clearly done, or whether it was the enemies that were outside the realm or the adhering.
Yeah.
And indeed, there's this rather wonderful picture during the appeal process, which this was the only basis for the appeal. The Lord Chief Justice and one or two other judges went to look at the statute rolls in the Public Record Office, which were all on parchment, and they didn't have commas. They just had bigger gaps or occasionally slashes in those days. And they decided that the gap in the parchment was caused by the folding of the parchment rather than an intent to put in a comma.
Sullivan, the defence advocate, his tenuous thread was broken by the judicial rebuke. After 2 hours on his feet, his eloquence completely deserted him. I regret, my lord, to say, I have completely broken down and sank into his seat, his head in his hands. And then I love George Bernard Shaw's line about him. He says, the intensity of his useless pleading has overcome him. So, I mean, was George Bernard Shaw a spectator at the trial?
George Bernard Shaw had, before the trial, written a defence for Casement, which Casement was quite keen to use, but his judicial team said, you can't possibly say that. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of self-justifying, I shouldn't be here, I should be being tried in Ireland defence. But he, because he was known to be an Irish nationalist, he didn't appear, he didn't give money, and he didn't appear in the courtroom himself, but he was very pro-Casement.
Yes. I mean, unsurprising in the context of that defence that it took the jury only 53 minutes to convict him. You know, a man who you know, still captured the public imagination, and for whom, you know, you'd have thought a robust defence should have been mounted. And yet the drama didn't end there.
Well, it's hard to say what such a defence would be. I mean, he'd been in Germany for over a year in a time of war.
But the speech he made in the dock was extraordinary.
The best speech he ever made. And yes, he gave a passionate speech which really illuminates what patriotism meant to him and means in general, and how, you know, he was tried in a London court, whereas if he'd been tried in an Irish court, it would have been very different, and so on. And it was an amazing piece of rhetoric stemming from the fact that I think he was on his way to becoming a martyr, and he knew he'd done everything he could, and now all he could do was
But before we, just on that, the pleas for clemency then were huge, weren't they? There was a huge campaign.
There was a resolution passed in the US Senate. The Archbishop of Canterbury pleaded to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister, Asquith, wrote to the Home Office and said, is there any way we can turn this into a... The only thing that would have given him clemency was a plea of insanity. So the Prime Minister said to the Home Office lawyers, is there any way we can get a plea of insanity? H.G. Wells, Bernard Shaw, Conan Doyle, all the great liberal writers and thinkers were putting in a petition. The British ambassador in Washington said, you have to spare him because otherwise the Irish-American lobby will prevent America joining the war. This was an extraordinary international outcry. And then the director of intelligence and this wicked policeman, head of the CID, it's a man called Sir Basil Thompson, had photographed the first 8 pages of his 1903 diary that had these sexual encounters we mentioned earlier, and made them available to anyone who wanted to see them. He sent them to the press, who initially didn't, before the trial, in fact, and the press said they wanted nothing to do with it. But then after the trial, the Express ran a headline saying he was a degenerate. The ambassador in Washington asked to see these papers, photographs, and they were sent to him. And we never heard anything more about clemency then. And the Archbishop of Canterbury recanted, and that was it.
And even when he wanted to convert to Catholicism because of the diaries, there was some reluctance.
Yes, and he wanted to convert Catholicism, his mother's religion. And initially there was indeed the prison chaplain, Catholic chaplain.
And there are still diary truthers, as well as are people who believe that the diaries were forgeries.
There are.
And you're going to confront them this weekend.
I'm going to confront them. Bertie Ahern said to Tony Blair in 1999, so after the Belfast Agreement and so on, he said, you must establish the truth of these diaries. And Blair organised them to be scientifically analysed. They were definitively proved to be by Casement in 2000. I also think they're all of a peace with the man, if you look at them. Yeah. And but some people, as you say, Dion, can't bear this
fact. But as you said, it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter. Like,
it doesn't matter at all. No.
There was a famous summer school in North Antrim at Garran Tower, you know, which is the most dramatic location of any school, the John Hewitt Summer School. But one of the, you know, recurring themes in that was casement. And the late, great Jack McCann, you know, very famous raconteur and solicitor, he made it one of his sort of missions to track down the last person who was believed to have ever seen Roger Casement or spoken to him. And he was a very old man, and he was a coal man, as it turned out, tracking it. And he'd gone to Ada McNeil's house. He used to deliver coal there. And he said to him, when he met him, he says, "Is it true that you spoke to Roger Casement?" He said, "It is." He got his notebook out and his pen, extremely excited about this revelation, because, you know, all the intrigue around Ada McNeil and Roger Casement. And he said to him, "You actually saw it?" "I did. Can you describe your encounter with him?" "I did. I went to the house with a bag of coal," he says, "and I knocked the front door. Casement opened the door. And I said, 'Where do you want this?' And he said, 'Round the back.'"
That's it. I want to end on what I think is like the words that actually sum up, capture the essence of the book, and also sum up Casement. The words of his executioner, which are incredibly haunting, when he said Casement was the bravest man it fell to my unhappy lot to execute. Mm. It's an incredible book, Roland, and it's been an honour to have you on Free State with us today.
I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Far across yonder blue lies a true fairyland, with the sea rippling over the shingle and sand, where the gay honeysuckle is luring the bee. Calling to me, I would halt at a cabin close down by the shore, and I'd knock with my heart at that wee cabin door, while the sun showered gold in the lap of the sea.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.